Hello, my friends. Welcome back to another episode of the Mental Corner Podcast, the show where I bring on guests from all different backgrounds to talk all the things mental health. I'm your host, Harry Povin, and today I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by Kevin Palmieri. Kevin is a podcast coach, a podcast host, and the CFO of Next Level University, which is a group that helps people use holistic self-improvement to maximize their life, their love, their health, and their wealth. Kevin is the man, and I had such a blast having him on the show, so I really want to thank him again for coming on and having this discussion with me. And if you're currently listening, whether you've listened before or not, please like, comment, share, subscribe, give 5 stars if you're on that podcast platform. Share with someone who might want to hear this episode. It's a really great one, and I can't wait for you to listen. I'll talk to y'all very soon. Have a great rest of your day. Peace. Are good to go. Kevin, what's going on, man? Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Of course, Harry. I am excited. I can't wait to chat. I'm excited to see where we go.
I am too. So my first question for all my guests is, what got you inspired to get into the line of work you're in today? Like, where does your whole story begin?
I grew up in a single parent household. I was raised by my mom and grandmother, so technically not single parent, but I didn't have a dad around, and I didn't meet my dad until I was 27 years old. So I think the through line of what I'm trying to do and be as a human being is I want to be what I didn't have. I never really had a positive male role model around to say, Kev, this is the way to be a strong man. This is the way to be a vulnerable man. This is the way to be a supportive man. This is the way to listen. And I think that's my goal. I want to try to be that for people. And I want to try to do it through example. I want people to see that this person who came from maybe very humble beginnings didn't forget where he came from, but he also doesn't allow that to stop him from doing what he wants to in the world. So yeah, I just want to be an example for what's possible, even when things don't seem possible. And one of the through lines of my story, Harry, and I told you I want to be authentic and vulnerable and truthful as humanly possible, is I might be 900 and some odd episodes in and quote unquote successful at this, but I still have days where it's like, I don't know if I could even do this coaching call. Am I good enough to do this? Why is this person paying me? I still have those days. I had a coaching call right before this, and 15 minutes before I was like, what am I even going to talk about? Is this going to be valuable? And it was a really wonderful call, but I still have those limiting beliefs that they visit more often than I think people want to admit.
Do you know where, like, because that's a big question that I've had on the show, because I myself am just looking for the answer. Like, where did these intrusive thoughts develop? Like, do you know where yours kind of came from?
I believe at the deepest level, I took ownership for my dad not being there. And I think if I had to guess, I internalized that as not being good enough, which made me question, okay, is this because of me? Is this because of me? And then you can start to play that out into the future. I was really good at baseball. I was an all-star baseball player. I got scouted by travel teams when I was younger, but I never felt good. I always felt like I got lucky. If I made an amazing play, I must have got lucky. It must have hopped right. If I hit a home run, I must have just swung at the right time. That instilled lack of belief in me, where if I decided I'm going to make the all-star team every single year from here on out, that would have instilled belief in me. It wouldn't have taken belief out of my sails. So yeah, I believe it was early on in childhood. I think that's where it came from. And then unfortunately, I didn't recognize that story that I was living until I was in my mid-20s. And then it started to make sense. But I think that happens with most people. Something happens when you're young. This is the analogy, or I don't want to say analogy, but this is the example I use. Our demographic is primarily women. And this is something we've seen. A lot of these women growing up when they were younger, they were told they're not smart enough, not pretty enough, not a good enough speaker, not whatever, not valuable. And they start attracting those relationships into their lives when they're young. And they have somebody who mirrors those thoughts and they're not super kind to them. And they get out of that relationship and then it happens again and it happens again because they haven't shifted the identity / limiting beliefs / what they believe they deserve. And I think my story is similar, just in a different way with different specifics.
Man, that hit close to home, because when my parents split up as a kid,
you don't really understand anything, because my whole thing was my life is perfect. My family's perfect. And I was like going into high school. I was pretty young. But when that happened, I kind of, the only way for anything to make sense was to go, this is my fault. It's because I'm not worth it as a son. And that like sounds ridiculous now, but when you believe it from like grade 8 all the way to like university, it like instills something in you forever.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting because you and I seem to be, so we have this thing we call the Drive to Five. Mm-hmm. Alan and I, Alan's the co-host, the CEO of the company, my business partner, co-founder. Alan in high school was very, very confident, maybe to an arrogant level. I was super insecure to a delusional level of like, nothing is possible for me. I can't do anything. So I was probably at like a 1. Alan was at like a 7, 8, 9. 5 is centered. 5 is you're confident, but you know you don't know everything. You're not afraid to ask for help. You know there's things that you're missing. You know everything is figure outable. That's 5. It, from our experience and what we've seen, almost everybody is off in their self-awareness of who they really are. It's just, are you over or are you under? There's some people, Harry, who imagine if they did grow up always having what they seemed or what they felt was a perfect life, a perfect family, a great bank account. And they had parents who always poured into their sales. You can do anything. Anything's possible. You're amazing. You being you is enough. That might eventually carry them to saying, well, I don't have to try hard. I just have to show up. Everything's going to happen for me. The universe is on my side, whatever it is. Where on the other end, if you had parents who didn't have the capability of pouring into you, you might have that opposite story of I'm not good enough. So I actually think that in a weird way, the not good enough is a power position because you can have other people pour into you to lift you up, where if you overshoot and your self-esteem and your self-worth is higher than whatever your natural set point is, you need people to humble you. You need people or the world to humble you. And that is a challenge that it's difficult. It's difficult to get humbled daily and still feel good about yourself. You know, it's very challenging.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It definitely is, man. And yeah, no, I completely agree, because I'm like my biggest humbler. Like my inner voice is like the biggest humbler I've ever met. You'll do something and it's awesome and people are like, congrats. And I'm like, no, I don't say that, please. I don't, I'm not worth it.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think that one of the things that I've really tried to work on, and I think it's helped me, is I try to look at the most recent relevant proof. I think you can find proof for your lack of skills or your actual skills. The problem is, are you looking at the right proof? I think about my first speech I ever gave. It was really good. All things considered, it went really, really well. I gave another speech a couple months later. I looked at my previous proof and said, this is going to be easy. I bombed it. Didn't go well. Then the next time I looked at that proof and said, okay, well, you have these two last reps. One went well and you prepped hard. One didn't go well because you didn't prep hard. All right, where's the sweet spot? So I didn't look at the most recent proof and just say, well, you can't speak because the last one sucked. I looked at the most recent and then the relevant, and then I try to tie those together. And I think that's an example or an opportunity for everybody out there of, if you failed at something in high school and you're 27 years old now, that is not recent and it's probably less relevant than you actually think. What is recent and relevant that you can focus on that will help you take a new step in a different direction? And then that becomes your new proof that's recent and relevant. It really, to me, is just the steps. It's just the building blocks to confidence, belief, and achievement.
It's so sad how like one little instance from so long ago can just limit yourself for the rest of your life if you let it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now when did you start realizing that you were building that confidence? Like when was it first apparent to you that you weren't as limiting in your beliefs anymore?
That's a great question. I would say the earliest was when I was 26, my girlfriend left me. And when she left me, I remember thinking to myself, I didn't like who I was because I was super insecure. I was a tattooed bodybuilder who had a very nice, loud car and seemed like he was crushing in life, which really messes with you when you're none of those things.
Right.
And I remember when she left, I had to look in the mirror and say, like, I don't think I am what anybody thinks I am. I don't even think I'm what I think I am. What am I actually? And I started working on that. I remember that that is when I started doing what we call fear chasing. I remember one day I didn't have any work that day. I was home alone. I had the day to myself. And I said, all right, you know what? I'm going to go down to the mall and I'm going to go have conversations with people. Like, I'm going to go find people that I find attractive and I'm going to go just ask them questions. I'm going to say, hey, excuse me, do you know where I can get this? Do you know where I can get this? And I started having conversations with people and realizing, oh, that's not that bad. It's not as bad as I made it out to be. What I did was I transitioned slowly from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. I think that's really all we're talking about at the end of the day is a fixed mindset means your limiting beliefs always win. A growth mindset means you realize that they're there and they exist and, you know, they have merit to them, but they're not the end all be all. And they don't have to be the guardrails to the way you live your life. So for me, it was going out and saying, okay, what scares me? Having conversations with attractive women I've never spoken to. Awesome. How do I cross the barrier just a little bit into that? I don't have to ask them for their number or, you know, have a pickup line. That's not what this is. This is more just ask them a question that gets you out of your comfort zone. And I think that was where I started. And in a weird way, Harry, that's all I've been doing for the last 5 years, just a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And that creates proof. I mean, at one point, my dream was to be interviewed on a podcast. And now I've been on 200 or whatever it is, however many, I just look at the last one I did. It's like, yeah, that went really well. I don't look at the first one. I do not look at the first one. I got to look at the last one.
Yeah.
Now, if you're early on, you have to compare to, and again, comparison can be a dangerous thing, but I think human beings are going to compare. You have to compare to where other people were at that point in the journey, right? Because if you're one episode in and you're comparing to somebody who has 975, it's not accurate. It's not relevant. Really, it's not relevant and it's not recent because that was 5 years ago. So that's a little bit of a tangent. But I think that if you can figure out what are the things that scare you the most and then find a way to do them in the least amount possible, that is how you begin to build confidence. That's how you begin to grow self-esteem. And that's how you begin to prove the parts of you that are running you wrong or right, depending on how they're running you.
Right. Man, that tangent, when I first started, this is another tangent, but I remember I used to be so hard on myself because I would do a recording, but I had my notes like right here and I was like shaking and I didn't know what I was doing and I kept messing up and everything. And I would look and I would watch like Joe Rogan and I'm like, how is he such a natural? And I just suck. And I'm like, oh wait, he's on like episode 1600 from like 10 years ago and I'm new. And he did stand up and UFC and all this stuff. So yeah, comparison is a killer, but it can like, there's such a fine line because like I can use it as motivation, but if I use it too much, I get so hard on myself.
Yeah. I think that human beings compare themselves in one of three ways. And it depends on where you are and your level of self-esteem and confidence. If you're somebody who has low confidence, and I don't mean that in any judgment way, I would say statistically, I have lower confidence than most. I've just worked on it more than most. But I would compare myself to the average, right? I made $100,000 at 26 with no college degree. Compared to the average 26-year-old, I was crushing it. Mm-hmm. I was crushing it. But that is where my self-esteem allowed me to compare. Now, if you have a high level of self-belief, you can compare to the top 1% or the most successful people in the world doing what you're doing. If you have visionary self-esteem and visionary belief, I think you compare to your maximum potential. And I think that when you get put into the wrong silo, if you have low self-esteem, you should not be comparing to the best in the world. That is a recipe for disaster. If you have low self-esteem, you should be comparing to either when somebody started or yourself yesterday, because that is the only thing that you know is true. This social media thing is really, really, really wreaking havoc on people's confidence because there's always that perfect car, that perfect house, that perfect vacation, whatever it is, where you don't know where these people started and you don't know what's really going on behind the scenes. You have no clue. You have no idea. So comparison is definitely a dangerous thing. And I mean, ideally you'd only compare to yourself, but I don't know that that's going to happen with human beings. I think that's kind of a high barrier to set.
I feel like it's just so, like deep in our roots that it's just hard to get rid of.
Yeah.
Man. On the topic of like fear chasing and everything, when you said that you broke up, sorry, I might get this wrong, but you broke up, your girlfriend broke up with you at 26?
Yeah, it was either, I think it was late when I was 25. I think it was October of my 25th year. So 25, 26, yeah.
And then you like reconnected with your dad at 27. Like, what was that experience like finally meeting him? Was it the first time you had met him?
So I had seen him when I was younger, but I was so young that I didn't consciously know. I would never, I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know my dad's name. I didn't know what he looked like. It was, I was sitting in my recliner, and I actually lived like 10 minutes from where I live right now. And I was sitting in my recliner and I was going through my Facebook messages, and I didn't know at the time that there was a folder for messages who people, if people weren't friends with you, like there was a random folder where people who weren't friends with you, their messages would go. And I didn't know that. Oh. And I was cleaning it out and I saw this message and it said, "Hey, I'm blank. I'm your father's girlfriend." And I think that's all I could see. And I was like, "Oh no, what is this?" And I opened it and it basically said, "Hey, I don't even remember her name. Maybe Robin. I'm your father's girlfriend. He wanted me to reach out and let you know how proud of you he is. He's been watching what you're doing. And if you are willing, he'd love the opportunity to meet for lunch." And I remember I threw my phone on the floor. I fell on the floor and started crying because I was the very ego heavy. I don't care about my dad. My dad could be dead right now. I don't care. I do not want to meet him. He doesn't deserve to meet me. And I think in that moment, that shifted everything. Of when it's not a possibility, it's pretty easy to say, "I don't care." But when the possibility arises, then what do? It was very, very, very challenging. And I remember I texted one of my friends and I said, "Hey, I just got this message and I am shaken right now. I don't know what to do." And my friend said, "Do you want me to come with you? I'll come do this with you." And I said, "No, honestly, I can tell internally, intuitively, I need to do this and I need to do it alone." So I messaged her back and I said, "Yeah, let's do it. Let's meet at this place." And I remember the day of, I was so terrified. I didn't want to do it. I was looking for excuses, but I remember when I got there, I walked in, I sat down, and I remember I didn't know what my dad looked like. So I had no idea how this person was even to find me. How are you going to, do you know what I look like? I don't know what you look like. And I remember watching a man walk by the window and just inside, I was like, "Yep, that's my dad. Okay, here we go." And he found me and we sat down and had a conversation and he ended up crying. And it was very heavy, but it was very relieving in a lot of ways. And we ended up spending, you know, a couple days together after that. But it's very hard when you're building a business and when you have all these things going on and all these pulls on your attention to have somebody come into your life and then, and pardon the example here, pardon the pun, but to let them skip the line. I know I'm supposed to love you and I know we're supposed to be tight and I'm supposed to make time for you, but I don't know if that's something I'm going to do. And I really haven't. I mean, we're on good terms, but I don't really foresee my dad being a large part of my life. That more was for closure, I think, for me, and forgiveness and empathy. You know, I understand. I've forgiven. You didn't want me as a son. It was an accident. I can only imagine how difficult that could have been at that time with everything going on. So it's helped me build a lot of empathy and forgiveness, but it's this weird, it's still a weird part of me. Right? It's like, I didn't know my dad for 27 years and I met my dad when I was 27, but we don't really spend any time together. And I know him now, but I kind of don't know him and I don't know if I'm going to spend any more time with him. So it's an interesting thing. The wound has definitely either healed or shifted. And maybe the wound is a different thing now, but it was probably, Harry, one of the most challenging things I've ever done. It was a real challenge to my courage and my confidence for sure. Very challenging.
How did it impact it afterwards, like moving forward from that day?
I felt like the part of me that was missing for so long had filled in. Like that chip on the shoulder that I had, I still have a chip on my shoulder, the underdog chip. I think I'll always have that. But the chip of the ego of like, I don't know, this is my identity. I don't know my dad. I don't need a dad. I don't care if he dies. That was how I lived for the first 26 years, 27 years. That shifted of, I know my dad, we've had great conversations. I just realized that maybe this isn't going to work out like it does for everybody else. Maybe our relationship isn't going to be what everybody else's is, but it's way different than it ever was. So I think it proved to me that I'm capable of way more than I thought. I mean, you know, getting up on stage is challenging. In front of people it's challenging. Podcasting is challenging. Coaching, being broke, all the things that, you know, I've gone through, but that is the most challenging thing I think I've probably ever done, ever.
Right, man. I wanted to backtrack a little bit, if you don't mind, I haven't been in this position, obviously, but when you're being raised by a single parent, and specifically a mother, when you're a son, like, what is that growing up like? When, like, where did you go to for like male role models and everything?
I don't know. I don't know that I ever did. My mom is pretty masculine. Like, my mom's kind of a badass. And nice. Yeah. I remember when I was in school, she said, don't ever punch somebody in the face, but if they punch you first, punch them harder. That was always the thing. Is like, if they hit you, you better put them down. I was like, all right, cool. I like that. I don't know. I think that I always loved, and it's interesting, right? Because you realize this retrospectively. I always looked up to people who stood up for the people that they loved. That was like a weird thing for me. I loved wrestling when I was young, and I always loved certain people. Like, I loved the Ultimate Warrior, jacked, like tough, could handle anything. You know, the movie characters, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, Jean-Claude Van Damme. I looked up to those types of people. And then as I got older, when I watched hockey, I always looked up to the enforcers, the people who would stand up for the other people on the team. And I think I just looked at people who seemed like strong male role models through Hollywood. I didn't really have a lot. I mean, you know, I had uncles and people around me, but a lot of my uncles got in trouble with the law when they were younger, so they weren't exactly the best role models. They're all great, and they all loved me, but I didn't really have anywhere to look. And I think that's why it took me so long to get rid of my ego, in a way, because I was spending time with other kids who were just trying to figure it out. You know, when you're 12, 13, 15, 16, 17, 18, you're just trying to figure it out. And I think that I had a lot of families who tried to kind of like, not adopt me, but adopt them as my second family. That happened pretty often, where I had like really good friends I'd always be at their house for dinner and for sleepovers, and they'd invite me to go places because I think they knew my family wasn't quote unquote normal. So I had a lot of people that tried to help and tried to role model and tried to lead by example. So I'm very blessed for that, but I don't think any of it ever really landed.
Now with your ego, like how did you start to chip away at it? Because we were talking about building your confidence and kind of facing your fears and everything. But when it comes to the ego, it's like a whole different game. So how did you start to chip away at that?
So we talked about this earlier. Humbling myself daily has been super, super helpful. Of all the people, Harry, who have ever told me podcasting is a dumb idea and won't work, none of them are podcasters.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, you have no idea what you're talking about. When's the last time you got in front of the microphone and got laughed at? You don't know, like you don't have the humility because you haven't had to practice it long enough. Humility in action has been the thing that has really, really removed my ego. And then I think the other part of it too is I really, really tried to look very, very hard at who I used to be and where I came from. And I realized that much of my ego was a coping mechanism for feeling small, feeling unheard, feeling broke, feeling insignificant, feeling like I wasn't manly enough or whatever it may be. It was that. It was those conversations with other people that tested my identity. And this is what I'll say too. Having a business partner like Alan, who's very focused on character, him and I are always challenging each other's character. And if somebody is getting arrogant, we have a conversation about it. Say, hey, I think you've gotten a little bit arrogant when it comes to blank, 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 blank. Just don't forget whatever. Right. So it's been on the top of my mind. I think that's probably the best way to put it is it's been a real, real every single day focus where yesterday, as for an example, my fiance was having one of her friends over and she said, hey, can you just help me clean at some point during the day? Like maybe you can do the bathroom and something else. You know, I'm having someone over. I want to make sure the house is clean. So yeah, I got you. And there was a couple times during where I was kind of short and a little bit rude, just because I was triggered and I was overwhelmed and my state was off and I'm trying to get work done. And I consciously recognize it. And then I say, hey, I'm so sorry that I was kind of mean back there. Like, my state's just a little bit off. My apologies. I didn't mean what I said. And she was like, yeah, you're good. Don't worry about it. Nothing happened. You're fine. But I'm always trying to look at my life through that lens, is my ego running? Is my intuition running? Is my fear running? What's running Kevin right now? And how has that paid off in the past? And then having that conversation with myself. And then the last thing I'll say, understanding that all human beings have egos. Harry has an ego. Kevin has an ego. Harry's ego is different than Kevin's. Kevin's ego is different than Harry's. It's just trying to protect us. And when you realize that oftentimes you don't need to be protected, there are certain things that if you ask me a hard question and I don't know the answer to it, I don't need to protect myself. I can just say, hey, I don't really have a great answer to that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that level of confidence in yourself, but also understanding that there's strength and vulnerability. There's a lot of strength in vulnerability. And I think if you understand that you can be vulnerable and safe, that gives you the permission to drop your ego sometimes. I like you. I feel your energy, Harry. I like you as a human being. So I feel safer here. Where if you were somebody who was arrogant, my ego would naturally raise up a little bit.
Right.
But I don't get that from you. It's very easy to just hang out and have a conversation. And I think that's the through line of that is you have to understand that if you can be like vulnerable in a moment, your ego doesn't have to be there. It can kind of go away. You can't have an ego and be vulnerable at the same time. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really work that way. Being vulnerable means you have the ability to be hurt. Kind of. I mean, if you think of what is the most vulnerable part of an airplane, it's probably the engines. If something gets in the engine, you're in trouble. What's the most vulnerable part of a rope where it's tied? That's where the worst amount of pain can happen. That's where things can go wrong. But you don't have to have an ego when you're being vulnerable because you understand that, hey, I'm going to put myself out there. Things could go wrong here. I'm just going to be me. So that's been very, very helpful, is having the opportunity and consciousness to be vulnerable as much as I can. That's really, really helped.
I love that, man. I think podcasting has helped a lot with that. Yeah. Because growing up, and I've talked about this too, I would ask questions in class when I was younger, and either teachers or other students would just make fun of you because it's a stupid question, but you didn't know the answer, so you were trying to get an answer, and then you'd get ridiculed. So then for a while, I was like, I'm not going to ask anything, and I'm just going to pretend I know the answer to everything. And then that's where the ego kicked in, where I was so arrogant that like someone would ask something that I didn't know, and I'd be like, you really don't know that? And I would just play it off. And I think podcasting has allowed me to ask the dumb, well, not dumb, but, you know, quote unquote, dumb questions to people, kind of let my ego down. And I think that's really helped me personally.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a similar experience with not wanting to ask questions. I wanted to be a firefighter during my many, you know, career shifts that I've had. And I went to the fire academy in Massachusetts. And I remember I didn't ask any questions. I was so afraid because there was people in there whose family, like their dad, grandfather, or their mom and grandfather or dad, like their whole family was in the fire industry. And I'm like, who am I to be here? Everybody knows everybody. They know what the hell they're talking about. They already work at the firehouse. I'm not going to ask any dumb questions. I remember when we got to the final two tests. So you take a written test and then you do two practical tests. I failed the first practical test because I didn't ask any questions. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I didn't know, not know what I was doing. Now I end up passing both and I get my certificate and I'm able to work on call. The first fire we ever went to, and if you're listening to this, really, really think about this. And if this lands, this is an opportunity for growth. So when you're on call, you get a pager and your job is to keep that pager on you 24/7. If it goes off, you get in your car and you go to the firehouse and it's like 3 a.m. and the pager goes off. And I'm like, oh my God, what is happening? I hop in my car, drive down to the station, get my gear on, hop in the engine. We're off. We pull up to a car fire in somebody's driveway. And I had no idea what to do. I had no clue what hose to grab. I didn't know what outlet to use. I didn't know what to connect to what. And I remember in that moment, I thought to myself, this is what you get for not asking any questions along the way. this is a thing we live by. You will always get the feedback. You can either choose to get it along the way, or you can wait and you can get it all at once at the end. I got it all at once at the end. And that was the last time I ever felt competent, like I could be an on-call firefighter. And I left shortly thereafter. I didn't ask the questions. And imagine if that was like a real life or death situation and something bad happened because I didn't have the courage to ask questions in class. That was a very, very big wake-up call for me. And now when we go places, like we went to a couple of Brendan Burchard events, and when we go, I make it a point to, if they say, does anybody have any questions, to stand on my chair and raise my hand, even if I don't have a question. My fiance and I went and saw Simon Sinek in New York, and he said, all right, we're going to do questions at the end. I sat on the floor for 25 minutes with my hand up so I could ask Simon Sinek a question. It was a terrible question. He kind of sort of laughed at me, which was weird. And it, obviously that doesn't reinforce things, but I know that if I don't ask questions, if I have one and I don't ask it, I don't feel good. Mm-hmm. I feel like I regret not doing it, not having the courage to do it. And that fire story is like, that's something I think about often. And I try to share it because not everybody has that opportunity to get such harsh feedback in real time. Make sure you're getting feedback along the way, because if you're not, you're going to get it eventually. If you're not weighing yourself every day, right, in 10 years, maybe you jump on the scale for the first time and you say, oh my God, I cannot believe this happened. Or I can't believe my relationship has gotten to this point. It's like, oh, you didn't check in along the way, right? I can't believe I only have $76 in my bank account. How did that happen? You didn't check in along the way. You will get feedback. You either get it along the way or you get it at once. I think getting it along the way is better because at least you can shift.
Absolutely. I got a lesson like that because I started doing Muay Thai about a year and a half ago.
Nice.
And they always give pointers like during training and everything. And you can see the people who kind of dismiss the pointers. They're like, no, I'll be fine. I'll be good. And then they spar at the end of the week and just get their butt kicked. And you're like, well, you didn't take the feedback then. Mm-hmm. Like there's people who, like my coach, it's basic stuff. Not my Muay Thai, but like the stuff he's teaching are like the fundamentals. He's like, hands up when you're punching. And you see the people who don't ever practice their hands up. They practice with their hands down. Get into sparring match, their head is like the first thing people go for. I'm like, well, yeah. You didn't take the advice then. it's like a harsh way of looking at that lesson.
Yeah. I'm a huge mixed martial arts, jujitsu, Muay Thai, boxing, wrestling. I'm a huge fan of all that. You asked earlier what helped your ego. That's that type of stuff where I had a client ask recently, I have a very, very, very confident son. Do you have any suggestions? Yes, martial arts. Because there's something extremely humbling about somebody who can hold you down and do whatever they want to you, and there's nothing you can do, and they're not even trying yet. That's so humbling. You either ego up or you say, you bow to it. Like, yep, you got me. I remember, yeah, rolling with people who are way better than me in jujitsu, super humbling. But you can't ego up, because if you ego up, you get hurt worse. Mm-hmm. That's the beautiful part of any, whether it's a contact sport or any martial art. Yeah, that's a good one. I'm proud of you for doing Muay Thai. Muay Thai is a wonderful thing.
Thank you. I needed to get back in shape. It was near the end of the first lockdown we had up here. And I was like, I used to be a competitive swimmer and I gained so much weight. And I was like, I need to lose this. And Muay Thai just kicked my butt. Yeah. I walked in, I was like, I was an athlete before, I'll be fine. And I think I threw up the second class. I was like, oh my God.
It's a different monster for sure.
Oh my God. They're like, all right, 3 minutes of bag work. I'm like, 3 minutes? It's like, freaking, that's nothing. And then you do 3 minutes. You're like, how many of these rounds are we doing?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's humbling.
It's very humbling. Very.
It's action. Whether if you lack confidence or if you lack humility, action is the cure-all. You just need to take action. The problem is most people don't, because they say, I either don't need it or I can't do it. Mm-hmm. Action. I mean, we get a lot of compliments. I get a lot of compliments when I go on shows of like, you've done 975 episodes. That's amazing. You're awesome. It's like, no, do you realize I thought I sucked and I still think I suck most of the time? You know, the first 150, I was like, I really hope I feel confident eventually. I really hope eventually I feel like I can do an interview without crapping my pants before. And then it crossed the line. And then it was like, you know, I'm still dealing with that for speeches. I think I've done 10 or 12 speeches on stage or something like that, I'm still not at the point where I walk on. It's like, okay, it's time. It's very much, I'm nervous. It's very much that. And the action, you have to take the action. It's the reps. So we have a formula for mastery. You prep, you prepare. Okay. You're doing a speech. What can I do to prepare? Okay. Prep, rep. You show up and you do your thing. You show up and you add as much value as humanly possible. So prep, rep. You reflect. You watch your previous performance, whether you can actually watch it, listen to it, or just imagine, right? And then you perfect. You perfect it. Say, okay, what did I do wrong? I said like too much. I said but. I said I said whatever it is. Then you make sure next time you prep, you use that perfection point. And then rinse and repeat. But it all has to, you all have to have a rep in there. There has to be an action, or there's nowhere for you to prove the concept.
Right. On the action part, I wanted to actually talk to you about the podcast and like how you've gone almost 1,000 episodes at this point. Mm-hmm. What prompted you and Alan to meet up and to make this podcast to begin with?
That's a great question. I, at one point in my life, Harry, I told a little bit about it where I was quote unquote successful and everybody would think that I was living the dream, beautiful girlfriend, all that amazing stuff. If you fast forward a couple of years after that, I was sitting at the edge of a hotel bed debating suicide because I was so miserable. I felt so hopeless, so helpless. I just felt like there was nothing left. I just felt like there was nothing left. I didn't like who I was. I didn't like my life. And there has to be more than this. I remember thinking that. Alan was the one I texted. I texted Alan and I said, hey man, I'm really going through it. I don't know what to do. I don't know if I can do this anymore. And he said, Kev, so much has changed for you over the last few years, but your environment hasn't. You got to change your environment. And then I ended up leaving my job and I ended up going full time into podcasting with Alan. So Alan and I went to middle school and high school together. And in middle school, we were great friends. I played spin the bottle with him and the popular girls in his basement. In high school, we kind of had a falling out because he was very confident and I was super insecure. But I remember I re-met Alan at a party. I got invited to this party, this big raging party, and I saw Alan there. And Alan was an entrepreneur. He had a beautiful girlfriend. He was in shape. He was a lot of what I valued, but I remember he had a podcast. And he's like, Kev, I want to interview you about fitness because I've always been into fitness. And I said, awesome, man, let's do it. And it kept getting pushed off. It kept getting pushed off. And I texted him one day and I said, Alan, we're doing this thing today. Like, I'm sick of pushing this off. Let's do this damn podcast. We did the podcast. At the end of it, I said to my other buddy, Andrew, imagine if you could do that for a living. Like, we just talked for an hour and a half and it went by in 5 minutes. Imagine if you could do that for a living. And Andrew said, you know, you can, right? And I went out and bought the equipment, you know, a couple of weeks later, and I had the Hyperconscious podcast. Alan had Conversations Change Lives. One day we said, you know what? Our goals are pretty much the same. We want to be the best men we can be. We want to impact the world. Why don't we just combine? We'll drop Conversations Change Lives and we'll go Hyperconscious. That's going to be the brand. Let's go. And from there, Alan and I just said, we're never going to miss an episode. We will be more consistent than anybody else. And together we can do more than anybody else because it's not about us. It's about helping. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like same for you. I mean, it's Saturday morning. Harry and I are jamming on a podcast. There's a lot of people who are waking up, nursing a hangover, nothing against their, I've been there or whatever they're doing. They're out fishing. There's nowhere I'd rather be than this. I love this. Helping people. People ask me all the time, like, what do you want to sell on the podcast? Nothing. I don't want to sell anything. I don't have anything to sell. I want to add value. That's the goal. So Alan and I partnered, and I think that we've been told by many people that it will not work working together. Business partnerships are dumb, whatever it is. But Alan and I are playing for the same thing, and it's our baby, and we're blessed that we get to do it all the time and every day. And it's something extraordinary. And I'm very, very grateful for an awesome business partner and an awesome best friend to have in the process. And it's just been a wonderful journey, Harry. It's been a wonderful, wonderful journey. And it all, the through line for us is it's more than us. It's not about the episode. It's not about the money. It's not about the speeches or any of that. It's about being the people that we needed when we needed us. And that's really what gets us through. It's a non-negotiable. It's a non-negotiable. I'm not podcasting to make money. I'm podcasting to change the world. And if you want to change the world, you better show up every single day as your best.
Absolutely. No, was it hard for you to open up on a podcast? Because when you're recording, like what we're doing right now, it's not like, for me personally, like no one else is watching right now, right? So you can say anything. But when you upload it, it's a whole different animal because you realize that that's in the world now. Like people can tune in. So was there ever a hesitancy for you to open up about your story and the stuff you've gone through based on the fact that people were going to watch?
No, not in the beginning. I think in the beginning, I had a little bit of ego towards it. I think I put up my ego to protect myself because I did a Facebook. So before Facebook Live was a Facebook Live, I think in 2012, I put a video up on Facebook and it was, I think the title was, "Do You Deserve to Be Happy?" And my whole thesis in this presentation, if you will, was you only deserve what you work for. I don't necessarily think you deserve more money than you're making unless you're willing to work for it. I don't think you deserve love unless you're willing to become the type of person who is capable of attracting and sustaining that love. And that was kind of like my first presentation. And I remember I didn't really care. I just said, like, I'm going to do this. And I don't know. I think people are either going to like it or they're not going to like it. And this is another part of me. I used to write raps in Facebook Notes, I think it was, where you could just like write it as a note and save it and people could see it. And I remember I have like a bunch. I think I had like 350 notes. I don't know if they're still there, but I always wanted to kind of perform. Mm-hmm. And I think in the beginning of podcasting, I probably just had my ego up of, well, I'm doing it and you're not. So, you know, what are you really going to say? But I get triggered when people say negative things, for sure. Still to this day, like, I don't like that. It bothers me that I get an ego with that. I get the fighter comes out of like, look, you know, would you say that to me in person? You know, that ego part, like, would you ever say that to me in person? Maybe. Yeah. I doubt it. And then it's that. So, but no, in the beginning, I think that I didn't like the sound of my own voice. I know that much. I think that's,
I feel that, man.
That's fairly normal. Yeah. But after hundreds and thousands of episodes, it's like, whatever, you know, whatever, it is what it is.
Yeah, man. Oh my, those comments. And you touched on it earlier. It's funny because most of the negative comments for anything, and I've noticed, I'm trying to become more conscious about this because for me as well, I get triggered by negative comments sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I take it personally all the time. I'm like, oh, how can I make it better for this one random person on the internet? But most of the people that are doing that, A, like you mentioned, aren't in that line of work, B, are just really unhappy with the situation they're in, or I don't even know if there's a C, but it's like, I noticed it when I was scrolling through Instagram the one day, and you're looking at basketball highlights, because I'm a big fan of basketball, and everyone in the comments is ripping on players, like, oh, they suck at doing this, they suck at doing that, and the comments are from this little white kid who's like 6 years old, who's just roasting like LeBron James about how to play basketball. And you're like, okay, like, you know way better than LeBron does about basketball. All right, yeah. Got it. Yeah. But it's interesting because we take those comments so personally. And like, sometimes I've caught myself trying to adjust how I present and how I do things based on what this random person is saying.
Yeah. And again, this is like a level of transcendence that I'm trying to get to, but I try to empathize. But to your point, they're probably just not very happy. Mm-hmm. You are so unhappy that you see me being happy and you have to say, I got to get this guy down a couple notches. I had somebody who reached out and like, it was like they were hunting me down. It was strange. It was weird. They commented twice on a post and then they DM'd me like 6 times. And I was like, what is going on here? Why? And the person literally said, like, get down off your pedestal. You act like you're saving people's lives when you're like talking into a microphone. And let me take you behind the scenes. Little does this person know that week I actually did talk somebody back from suicide. They have no clue. They'll never know because they don't listen. But no matter what you're doing in the world, if there's people out there who aren't doing what they feel they should, they're probably going to try to tear you down for doing what you're doing. And I think that the ultimate goal is empathy, to your point, Harry, if you wake up every day and you go to a job you hate and you're in a relationship you don't like, in a body you're not proud of, with a bank account that doesn't help, like, yeah, you're going to get mad at me. I'm going to be a big mirror. And that's something that's been happening more and more, where it's like, oh, okay, I can see that I trigger you based on my reality. And honestly, I probably would have triggered myself. I think that's where the empathy comes from. I was the kid who always used to say, must be nice, must be nice, it must be nice. So I can't really judge, well, I can, but I shouldn't judge other people's reactions to myself without thinking of what my reaction to myself would have been 7 years ago. I probably would have hated me. I probably would have hated me, honestly. That's in this moment, I'm walking through that. So I appreciate the deep dive there.
You're welcome. But that just means you've grown so much. Is that old you would have, like for me, I'm kind of the same way. Old me would be looking at these videos like, what are you doing?
Why
are you doing this podcast, man?
Yeah. Well, old Harry wasn't going to change the world. New Harry can.
Man, all right. I'm taking that to heart. Thank you, sir. I guess another point of emphasis I wanted to touch is, you know, in terms of consistency, that's a big, difficult thing for a lot of us to deal with or to do for anything. And I think for me, like, I can only relate to myself, obviously, personally, but when I'm really in a groove of something, or I'm starting to get that consistent momentum, whether it's like Muay Thai or podcasting, or I don't even know, when I was in school studying or anything, I always get that intrusive thought of, you can skip today. You're doing well enough where one day isn't going to, nutrition even, like, oh, you can have a cheat day. Like, how do you take those thoughts and kind of just not apply them?
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's a challenge. And this might not work for everybody. I am very, very, very honest with myself of, I have the conversation, and I do this all the time. I either do this thing that I have determined that is lined up for me to be the most successful version of myself, or I don't get the result and I don't get to complain about it. Take your pick. Up to you. I try to be the bad cop with myself, where there has to be more pain associated with not doing it than doing it. And most of us just don't have those measures built in, because if you're running for your health, that's one thing. If you're running to run a marathon in 6 months, you're going to treat the marathon running a little bit different, because there's more pain. If you show up out of shape and you try to run 26 miles, it's probably going to be pretty challenging. Where if you just say, like, I'm not going to run anymore, there's no pain there. You have to build in accountability, and you have to build in necessity. And those two things are scary, because they make you do stuff you don't want to do, because the pain is great enough. Alan and I, it's very appropriate that you asked this. We did an episode on Wednesday, and Alan and I are both committed to losing 10 pounds each by August 1st. I'm going away to get married on July 31st. And yes, it's all happening. And Alan wants to look good so he can go to the beach, but he's never going to go to the beach, so it doesn't really matter. But still, so we said, okay, how do we stay accountable to each other? You and I are really good at consistency. Let's tie this into how we can help our listeners. And I said, okay, what if we do a commitment device? So a commitment device is where you, for example, say you are vehemently against smoking. If you do not accomplish your goal in the given time, you have to donate $100 to a smoking company. You have to take your hard-earned money and give it to something you don't believe in. And it has to be something that you hate, because the pain must be great enough. The pain of not accomplishing your goal must be greater than doing it. So I said to Alan, we started there. I'll donate $500, or I'll invest $500 into Philip Morris Tobacco Company. Alan, you'll invest $500 into Anheuser-Busch. And then we realized, well, if we make money and then we sell it, it's not really that bad, because we're making money. In the grand scheme of things, $500 for them isn't that much. Okay, what can we do? I said, what about this? If you and I do not make weight, we don't get to record a podcast episode. So if you come in heavy, I record the episode alone. If I come in heavy, you record the episode alone. If neither of us accomplish it, we miss for the first time in 1,000 episodes. Are you in? And he's like, dude, yes, we won't miss. We can't. I'll literally shave my head. If I miss, I will shave my head in order to make that weight. But the pain of not accomplishing it is greater than the pain of me dieting for 3 months. That is a hack. And like the accountability portion. So a lot of people say, don't publicly state what you want to do. I disagree. I think you should publicly state what you want to do, because then you know that there's more pressure. There has to be some necessity. There has to be some necessity. Nobody does something for nothing. just doesn't work that way. There has to be some level of necessity. So whether it's a peak performance partner, that's huge. A commitment device, that's awesome. A community, whatever it is, there has to be a bigger reason than you, whether it's more, more pain, more discomfort, whatever it is. That's how we do it. But we also have a team who can see everything. I have habits that I track every day. Everybody in the team can see it. So if I don't get 100%, everybody knows, right? So as much as I'd like to say I'm just the most consistent human on the planet, there's just people watching what I do every day, which helps to keep me consistent. I'm a people pleaser, you know? And if you're a people pleaser, you can use that tendency to improve your consistency as long as you have the courage to do it in the first place.
Right. Yeah. Having a team around you is so helpful. Mm-hmm. Like not even just a team, but like friends and family around that have, you know, matching goals as you, it's been a game changer.
It's for sure.
Man, I love that. Well, Kevin, I mean, this has been an absolute pleasure. I think my last question for you, man, is, you know, if there's anyone listening who, and you actually mentioned this, is kind of looking at you as a mirror and kind of negatively going, you know, like he's got everything that I wish I had, blah, 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 all of that stuff. What would you want to tell them if you were in an actual room with them?
Odds are you probably believe in yourself more than I do. Some days I don't believe any of this is real. And it's like, I don't know how we even got here. What is real? And then there's some days where it's like, we got 20 something thousand dollars, you know, sent into our bank account and it was cool for like 10 minutes. And then it was like, okay, back to life. So I would say that I'm just a regular person who has done the right habits for a long time. And I was the same as you in terms of I would be judging myself too. It's one of those things of if I don't fit into your identity as the type of person who can help you, you're probably not going to want to hang out with me because I'm going to be a pain in the butt. So I empathize. I understand. I love you either way. And if you want to help me do my thing, I appreciate it. If not, I just hope you do your thing. That's what I would say.
I love it, man. Kevin, where can everyone find you?
The best place to reach me is at NeverQuitKid on Instagram. I will answer my DMs. I always answer my DMs. And then Next Level University is our podcast, 7 days a week, about to cross 1,000 episodes soon, as Harry said. So all the major podcast platforms, and then we're on YouTube as well.
Ooh, I love it. I'll put those links down below. Kevin, once again, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Right back at you, Harry. This was wonderful. All the love for you. I'm excited to stay connected, brother.
Absolutely. And to all my listeners, I will see you guys next time.